From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a true crime story. Sarah Weinman has written a book about a little girl who was kidnapped by a creepy middle-aged man who drove her around the country and sexually abused her. Her name was Sally Horner, and it just so happens her story helped inspire Nabokov's also creepy book, Lolita. Weinman put two and two together and made the connection, so she'll join us to talk about the real Lolita in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Sarah Weinman tells crime stories for a living. And when she finds one that ignites in her, that's how she puts it, ignites in her this sense of obsession and compulsion, then she knows it's a story she wants to tell. A few years ago, Weinman came across the story of Sally Horner, a little girl from Camden, New Jersey, who was kidnapped in 1948 by a man who drove her across the country, enrolled her in school, posed as her father, but regularly raped her and manipulated her. And this went on for nearly 2 years. When Weinman first learned about Sally Horner, she felt that obsession with the story. And then she learned it was connected to Vladimir Nabokov's novel, Lolita. That story also about a young girl victimized by a man posing as her father. She learned that Nabokov heard about Sally Horner at a time when he was struggling with his novel. So he hadn't gotten the idea from the Sally Horner case, but even though he always downplayed the connection, Sarah Weinman says it made a difference to the way Nabokov thought about the book and how he wrote about it. Weinman weaves the story of Lolita and Sally Horner together in her own book called The Real Lolita. And today in the program, she's joining us to talk about it. Sarah Weinman is a journalist and crime fiction authority. She's the editor of Women Crime Writers. She joined us from a studio in New York. And we began by talking about a photograph of Sally Horner. Weinman says it's the picture she thinks of the most.
Sally Horner was 9 years old. And at that point in her life, she was, I suppose, on the cusp of doing whatever she was supposed to be doing with her life, going to school in Camden, and her older sister, Susan, had been recently married, and she would be pregnant and about to have her first child, which would make Sally an aunt. And it wasn't also that far removed from when her father, Russell, had died. He had killed himself. Yeah. And so Sally's life was sort of based in tragedy and in hard labor and in poverty and in struggle, but she was also like an ordinary kid.
Yeah.
And so to look at that photograph and see potential, to see promise, to see someone who had not yet been marked by all the things that would happen to her subsequently, it just really struck me just to see normality as this extraordinary thing.
Talk a little bit about how you found this story. You talk about stumbling upon it. And in fact, it caught your attention, you say, with a particular urgency. Explain that.
So I'm a crime journalist. And I suppose what I do is at the intersection of where crime meets 20th century culture, in large part because I feel like that's when we start to lose direct sense of what had happened. So people who were still alive are starting to pass away. Information that may have been readily available is no longer so. And as a result, hunting these people and this information down becomes a real challenge. And I enjoy challenges. And so I had just come off a story and I was looking around for my next story. And I like to joke that I'm a child of the internet. And so what that means is I often spend too many late nights looking at some Molotov cocktail mixture of Wikipedia pages and Reddit threads and Web Sleuths pages and random message boards related to old crimes or missing persons cases. And somewhere in all of that, I landed on this 2005 Times Literary Supplement essay by a Nabokov scholar named Alexander Dolinin. Yeah. And it was called What Happened to Sally Horner? It wasn't the first time I'd read this piece, but it was the first time that this piece really stuck in my mind. Mm. And so I'm reading about this now 11-year-old girl from Camden, New Jersey, who had been kidnapped and taken on this 21-month cross-country nightmare. And then only 2.5 years later, Sally would pass away herself in a car accident. And to see that her story was incorporated into this iconic and this brilliant and this controversial novel, Lolita, in a parenthetical that reads, had I done to Dolly, Dolly being Dolores Hayes, the fictional character who is abused and repeatedly raped by Humbert Humbert, the novel's protagonist. Had I done to Dolly, perhaps, what Frank LaSalle, a 50-year-old mechanic, had done to 11-year-old Sally Horner in 1948. So there's this parenthetical. Yeah. And because so much is happening in Lolita as a novel, it's easy to kind of lose track that something important is happening in this parenthetical, that it could be about a real-life case and a real girl. I asked myself, had anybody reported out Sally Horner's story as a piece of journalism, as a crime story? And of course, I wasn't just going to do it as a straight-up true crime tale without also incorporating the deeper links to Lolita.
Yeah.
But I knew with my own skill set and my expertise that I could ask certain questions that literary scholars might not. What I did was something of a reconstruction, that I was putting pieces together and creating this mosaic that is in part telling Sally's story and creating, as best as I could, a three-dimensional portrait of this young girl. But I was also, in parallel, telling the story of how Nabokov wrote Lolita, the struggles that he had, and the weird cultural afterlife that it would ultimately have as well.
But how is it that Lolita becomes infamous and then embedded in popular culture extremely? It absolutely changes Nabokov's life, transforms him into a literary celebrity. And how is it that that happens? And Sally's story, as you mentioned, becomes forgotten. Why is that, do you figure?
I think in part because there was some deliberation on Nabokov's part to emphasize that Lolita was the singular work of art.
Yeah.
And so we see it as something that kind of sprung out of nowhere. But of course, it really had quite a difficult genesis. He had been working through essentially this compulsion, this idea of a middle-aged man's illicit, illegal, and disturbing lust and obsession with a prepubescent girl.
Right.
And so he was working through it in early poems and early short stories. And even Lolita, it wasn't as if he wrote it in a flash. He had been working on it off and on for about 5 or 6 years. There were stops and starts. There were periods of time when he wanted to burn the entire manuscript before his wife, Vera, intervened. And so coming across Sally's story most definitively upon her death in 1952, at a critical point while Nabokov was writing Lolita, that absolutely enabled him to keep going on this manuscript. And within a year and a half, he had a completed manuscript.
Yeah.
Of course, it didn't get published right away. Several publishers were too nervous. They felt that they wouldn't be able to defend this manuscript in court. And so they rejected Lolita. It was then first published by Olympia Press in France. But the version that Nabokov was most happy with came out in 1958. And it was first it was published in the States, and then eventually it would be published in Canada and the UK and onward. And so once Lolita sort of bubbled up in the culture, because between 55 and 58, there were a number of prominent literary types, people like Edmund Wilson and Mary McCarthy and Dorothy Parker, where this manuscript was almost being passed around like samizdat. And it's like, it was like the manuscript that no one wanted you to read. And so that's how it sort of built up a particular kind of cultural cachet. But by the time it was published and it landed on bestseller lists, that's when this weird cultural afterlife began, where you had comedians like Groucho Marx and Milton Berle making jokes. You had literary critics equating Humbert Humbert and Dolores Hayes' relationship as this great love story. And of course, a lot of the way that people interpret Lolita the novel is actually how they're interpreting adaptations of Lolita, specifically the 1962 film that Stanley Kubrick directed and that starred Sue Lyon as Dolores Hayes and James Mason as Humbert Humbert and Shelley Winters as Dolores' mother, Charlotte. And so because of iconic imagery like Sue Lyon wearing the heart-shaped glasses, that theme song, and just the fact that she was older, she was about 16, as opposed to the actual character being closer to 12. So these differentials created this idea that the term Lolita is synonymous with seductress. So if, I mean, there are many things that I hope that my book accomplishes, but if I had to choose one thing, it's to decouple this idea that the term Lolita and seductress should be inexorably intertwined. I want to break that shackle for good.
Yeah. Nabokov was clearly influenced by this story, that there's really only circumstantial evidence. That's how you put it.
Yes.
But the question is, would there have been a book, Lolita, without Sally Horner? You say, yes, of course there would have been. But the influence on it is important because you mentioned that hearing about Sally's story seemed to give Nabokov a new purpose, because he was literally thinking about he actually tried to do this, destroy the manuscript a couple of times before all of this.
Yes, that's right. And so, as I mentioned before, it's timing is critical. I mean, yes, there is no question in my mind that he would have written a book either titled Lolita or something akin to this because he had been working through this idea for so many years that clearly it nagged at him, it gnawed at him, it was a compulsion. Mm-hmm. And we also know this because even after Lolita was published, Nabokov would write works that referenced this particular illicit relationship, but in a more metafictional or postmodern way. Mm-hmm. So even then, even after the spectacular success of Lolita, he still couldn't let go of this particular motif. And it was still this compulsion that had a grip on him. That said, I mean, just the fact that there is this note card that exists in his archives, mm-hmm. his original archives at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., that recopies a Wire story about Sally's car accident death. So to see Sally Horner's name in Vladimir Nabokov's writing, it was so strange and so thrilling to have that tangible connection between life and art and mm-hmm. to know that he did incorporate her story. And it wasn't just the basic outlines of her cross-country nightmare. It was little details like the prison sentence that Frank LaSalle would ultimately serve for kidnapping Sally, height and weight differences, appearances, the fact that LaSalle was originally indicted on the Mann Act, and Humbert Humbert references that as well. So there are all these like little details that do find themselves in Lolita. And would Nabokov have been able to do the same thing if he had found another crime? Sure. But as I discovered, what happened to Sally was this kind of singular, sensational event that did generate so much media coverage when she was rescued in March of 1950. And so while I don't have a similar note card for 1950 as I do for 1952, I do think that the breadth and the depth of media coverage of Sally's kidnapping and rescue makes it a fairly likely possibility that he would have read about it.
When did you first read Lolita? Because you say you kind of dared yourself to read it, and now as you look back on it, you probably shouldn't have, or at least then you weren't quite ready.
Well, I was 16 years old,
yeah.
And I in my mind, I was a very precocious, smart-ass 16-year-old. So keep in mind, I was growing up in my native Canada, and at that point, the graduation age was 19, and I graduated high school at 17. So I was closing in on my in my senior year. And I'd been reading Canadian literature, so Margaret Atwood, Margaret Lawrence, Alice Munro, Robertson Davies. And somehow, I think in class, we were studying dissident literature. So I recall reading Alexander Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which I quite admired. And I think somehow that just led me to Lolita, in part because it was another contemporary Russian writer, a dissident, but also it was much more, or what I thought was salacious and controversial. And I began reading it. And I became aware, I was disturbed, of course, and I was thrilled.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a brilliant novel for so many reasons. But I just remember becoming acutely aware that Humbert Humbert was not to be trusted, that his narration was unreliable. And it was the first time in my reading life I had encountered a wholly unreliable narrator. And it sort of shifted me on my axis a little bit. But in mostly, it opened me up to what literature could do and its possibilities in ways I just had not considered before. And so even though I still think I was probably too young to read Lolita, I should have waited till 18 or 19, I do think that it was preparing me to become a more sophisticated reader.
Yeah. Interesting you say that Humbert Humbert uses flowing, beautiful language in that novel, of course, but that hides the fact that he raped a 12-year-old child again and again and again and got away with it.
Absolutely. And I think we should never forget that. But that is the genius of Lolita,
right,
that we get ensorcelled
into
Humbert Humbert's perspective, into his viewpoint, even though, and whenever I reread Lolita, I always go back to its introduction written by, quote, John Ray Jr., and it's done as sort of a case history. And everything is right there. We know what Humbert Humbert has done. We know that his victim does not live very long. And we know that he's in prison and he's left behind this, quote, memoir. And so it's all there for the reader to know and to see. But as soon as we get into Humbert Humbert's voice, light of my life, fire of my loins, all of a sudden we're in his voice and that just takes over everything. And so when we get to scenes, for example, like the one in the Enchanted Hunter's motel, which is the first time that Humbert Humbert rapes Dolores. And of course, he's telling it as if she instigated it, that she wasn't a virgin.
Yeah.
And so he has all these justifications, but there's really no reason for us to A, believe him, B, trust him, because we only have his word. And why is his word more important than the word of Dolores Hayes? And so what I'm hoping, by casting this light on what happened to Sally Horner, that it also casts new light on what happened to Dolores Hayes.
Yeah.
So that we can remember and recognize her for what these two girls, real and fictional, what they both endured, what they both survived, what they overcame, even though what they overcame didn't last terribly long.
Yeah. Explain what happened to Sally Horner, and begin, if you would, with the encounter at the Woolworths in Camden, where she'd been kind of peer pressured to go and steal a notebook by some friends.
So it was March of 1948, and Sally was a month away from her 11th birthday. She wanted to join a girls' club at school, and the initiation rite was to steal a 5-cent notebook from the Woolworths, the local five and dime downtown. And she went in with some trepidation, understandably, and fear, and was just about to complete the task when she felt a hand on her arm. And she looked up at this middle-aged man whom she viewed as positively ancient, and he said, "I am an FBI agent, and you are under arrest." He was not an FBI agent. Yeah. She was not under arrest. But because of her age, her youth, her inexperience, her innocence, she believed him. But he said he was going to let her go. And so he did, and she went about the rest of her school year for the most part. And then one day on her way home, she encountered this man again, and he upped the stakes. He said that if she didn't do as he said, not only would he arrange for her to go to reform school, but worse things would happen. So she would have to tell her mother, Ella, that she was to go away for a week to the Jersey Shore and that he was the father of school friends. So she went home and she told her mother. There was a telephone conversation which made her mother believe the story even more. Mm-hmm. And then on a mid-June day in 1948, Ella kissed her daughter goodbye at the bus station, saw her off, and saw Sally sitting next to somebody resembling a middle-aged man, some kind of shadow.
A man she did not meet, by the way. We should just...
A man she did not meet, indeed. Yeah. And for the first few weeks, she didn't really feel that anything was particularly amiss. Of course, this time away for her daughter kept getting extended.
Yeah.
Sally would write letters. She would send postcards. She would even phone home, giving excuses as to why they needed to stay longer in Atlantic City, that the ice follies had come in, that people were visiting longer. And then Ella first gets a letter from Sally saying that they're going to be on their way to Baltimore. And then she gets a phone call from a pay station, and Sally says that she's not going to write anymore.
Yeah.
And that's when something woke up inside Ella's mind, and she alerts the police. So Camden police arrange with police in Atlantic City, and they descend on an address that had been given in postmarks of Sally's letters. And they don't find Sally. They don't find Frank LaSalle. They do find some suitcases and other belongings, including a photograph of Sally, where she is sitting on the swing, looking straight at the camera. In all likelihood, it was LaSalle who took the photo. And there's this mixture of fear and hope that something might come of this, and an eagerness to please.
So she's basically been abducted. She's taken now to Baltimore. Frank LaSalle doesn't chain her to a bedpost. He enrolls her in a couple Catholic schools. Talk a little bit about this, and because this is, I think, the idea, these abduction ideas and these motifs are really interesting. And this particular idea that he's enrolling her in class, that he builds up this narrative for her to tell to other people, is interesting, and it's kind of a theme.
Yeah, I mean, you're based in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And so one of the narratives I relied on heavily from a psychological standpoint was Elizabeth Smart's memoir.
Right.
And she, of course, had been in a somewhat similar situation. Those hers lasted 9 months and Sally's lasted 21 months. But psychologically, there are a lot of similarities. This idea that the victim is broken down and essentially told that the people in their lives who love them no longer love them anymore, that they're worthless, that they're hopeless. And they are abused and they are raped and they're violated. And so it's not so much physical shackles, but it's psychological and emotional shackles. And they do the work, if not equally effectively, maybe even more so. Because then what happens is these girls and women predominantly go into some kind of survival mode where just getting through the day is a victory. And this idea that telling someone of their plight could produce more dire consequences, most likely death.
Yeah.
And so getting out of that mindset is extraordinarily difficult.
We'll get to the part of the story where they leave, make this road trip from Baltimore to Dallas.
Yes.
In Dallas, where she finally reveals to a friend that this relationship with her quote-unquote father had become sexual. And then they go to California, where the story unwinds completely. But let me back up and talk about Nabokov in 1948 now. What's happening with him? This was an important year for him. This was interesting. He travels across the country three times at this point, does another three trips, I think, later. His wife, Vera, is doing the driving.
For
the most part, right? Exactly. And they do these trips sort of on the cheap. But it certainly brings to mind the way Humbert waxes on about the dreamy country of America. Just talk about what's going on in 1948 for Nabokov.
So by that point, Nabokov, his wife Vera, and their son Dmitry had been living in the United States for about 8 years. They had landed in 1940 in New York. Then they made their way to the Boston area, where Nabokov taught at Wellesley College. But he also had a fellowship through Harvard at the Comparative Zoology Institute because, aside from being a brilliant novelist and writer, he had a really amazing sideline as a lepidopterist.
Yeah.
He was passionate about hunting butterflies. And so that's how he and his family spent the summers. They would drive across the country, make their way to the American West, and he would walk for miles and miles and miles holding a butterfly net, looking for specific species, and he would write papers. So he was very well regarded in that world. By 1948, though, they were preparing to move from the Wellesley area to Ithaca, New York, where Nabokov was about to take up a teaching position at Cornell University.
Right.
And he would remain there through 1958. So it was interesting to me that the story, Sally Horner's story, but also the story of Lolita, really intersected almost perfectly in this parallel way with the great changes in Nabokov's life that saw him move from one city to another, and then writing Lolita and publishing Lolita and it becoming a success.
That summer, he discovers this book that would have an important influence. It's called Studies in the Psychology of Sex. And there's this appendix about this Ukrainian engineer who becomes sexually obsessed with young girls that kind of catches his eye.
So this wasn't the first instance in which Nabokov had some kind of interaction with someone who had Humbert's proclivities.
Yeah.
He had spent some time at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, where he befriended this man, Henry Lunds, mm-hmm. and they would play chess together. And over these chess matches, Lunds would tell him of his own predilections for prepubescent children. And eventually Lunds would commit suicide. But Nabokov clearly viewed this as material, whether to use right away or to file away or as an interesting person. And then he, over the course of his long correspondence, first as a friendship, but then eventually they fell out with the literary critic Edmund Wilson. That's how this book by Havelock Ellis, that's how Nabokov knew about it. And he had read of this Ukrainian man and his own predilections. So all of which is to say that there were many seeds mm-hmm. for Lolita.
Yeah.
But, of course, inspiration is not necessarily a one-to-one binary thing. You take a little bit from here and a little bit from there and a little bit from this corner and a little bit from that corner, and the resulting alchemy can produce amazing works of art.
Sarah Weinman, her book is The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner, and the novel that scandalized the world. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the crime writer Sarah Weinman. We're talking about her book, The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner, and the novel that scandalized the world. I wanted to ask you about the experience of writing your book, particularly the research part, because you've done this a lot. But something about this story seems to have been different, because you say digging into the archives was like coming up against an electrified fence. Talk a little bit about that. And because you knew that Nabokov would have hated the idea of someone digging around in the details about his life or tried to find some real story that would help explain any of his work, let alone Lolita.
And I knew that he would have despised it because he had a very contentious relationship with his first biographer, Andrew Field, where, again, that relationship started off warm and very cordial and then devolved into near litigation and Field subsequently writing a book that is essentially like a hate read of everything Nabokov related. And so that's kind of what I knew I was up against. I also knew that both Vladimir and Vera Nabokov were very careful about what they wanted to convey to the world. I mean, Vera burned her own letters. She was mendacious to Nabokov's second biographer, even after he revealed that he had specific information about Nabokov's personal life and affairs with certain women. It was about protecting the brand. It's this idea that Vladimir Nabokov, the great artist, mattered above anything and everything else. Yeah. And so when people poked around for real life inspiration or whether he himself might share Humbert's predilections, this needed to be slapped down right away. And I can understand that because Lolita needs to stand apart. But at the same time, what I wanted to understand and thus show to the reader is that the creation of art is a much more complicated thing and it involves a lot more nuance. And so what I felt as a researcher going through in particular Nabokov's archives, not just in D.C. at the Library of Congress, but also at the New York Public Library in the Burke Collection, I felt that I could get at something as much by what I could find versus what I could not find.
Yeah.
And so I found it fascinating, for example, to find so much ephemera related to the publication and afterlife of Lolita, and yet there was no shred of anything about Sally Horner other than this note card, even though there is a published letter that Vera, writing on Vladimir's behalf, wrote to a New York Post reporter when he was poking around, first asking in 1963 whether there was some connection between Sally's kidnapping and Lolita. And the reason he was asking is because a different journalist, a man named Pete Welding, had written a piece for a men's magazine called Nugget.
Yeah.
And he was the first to make the overt connection. And so this other journalist, Al Levin, thought, huh, I have a story here. I should write the Nabokovs and see what they say. And the letter, which is reprinted in full in my book, yeah, is just a wonderful piece of audacity.
Yeah. She says, no, there was no inspiration whatsoever.
And yet also says, oh, yes, but this case is referenced directly in Lolita. So you can't have it both ways here.
Right.
And yet, of course, they really wanted to.
But it's interesting. One of the things you say is, and you're really clear about this, that the real little girls should not end up getting lost in this need for artistic license. The abuse that girls like Sally Horner went through, you say, shouldn't be subsumed by dazzling prose. Do you think that's what's happening? The idea that this is a beautiful, brilliant novel makes people lose track of the fact that this was a young girl who was being raped repeatedly by a middle-aged man.
I do. And I mean, I think on the one hand, I think that artists should be free to write whatever they want.
Yeah.
That is the domain of art. And we can always learn and take something away from it that's really important. Art is supposed to stand the test of time. But on the other hand, I do think it's important to probe at the responsibility that artists have when using real people and real life as inspiration, and especially when it's a real life crime and where essentially one is fictionalizing someone else's pain. And so I still reread Lolita and I still think that it is one of the greatest works of the 20th century. But I think that it's just as important to know about Sally Horner and that she matters. And if Sally Horner matters, so do all the other girls, women, young men, young boys, anyone who has suffered abuse and trauma. They deserve to matter and to have their voices heard loud and clear in the same way that great art, works of art can stand up and be heard too.
I find it interesting too that Vera, while she writes this letter on behalf of her husband in reply to this reporter, Alan Levin, who said, wait a minute, is there a connection there? And she says no, and yet it's referenced, you know, that she mentions that parenthetical phrase that you referenced earlier. But you also say that she wrote in her diary that she was troubled by all the acclaim for Lolita in the sense that people forgot there was a little girl at the center of the book.
Right. And I mean, Nabokov would also later say that he viewed Dolores Hayes or Lolita as one of his very favorite characters. This idea that she was the heroine and it would be easy to lose sight of it because on the one hand, he wasn't going to insist on how to read his novel. If anything, that was the antithesis of how Nabokov wanted anyone to read any great work of literature.
Yeah. You decide. Do it yourself. You come up with whatever conclusion you want. I won't tell you how to conclude it. But people were coming up with these very strange conclusions. He must have thought. It certainly Vera did.
Right. And so, of course, the difference between what Vera wrote privately versus what she conveyed publicly, that's also a dissonance that I wanted to probe at because there is this incredible disconnect. And so ultimately, I think that the sentiment and the emotion that she expressed in this diary entry, where she did hope that people would realize what a terrible thing that Dolores had gone through. But it's just, I think it comes down to this idea that Lolita is supposed to be viewed as a love story. I was just recently rereading an interview that James Harris, who was Stanley Kubrick's producing partner on Lolita and other movies like Paths of Glory. And the whole reason that the movie is the way it is because they went in with this interpretation that this novel needed to be presented as a, quote, bizarre love story. And if there's any reference of Humbert Humbert's predilection for little girls, that would destroy the fabric of the movie. And so if they're going out of their way to downplay Humbert Humbert's sexual desire for prepubescent girls, of course people would interpret the novel through the movie, which had a false interpretation. And so I think just stripping all that away and getting at the core of what is really happening and looking past this, quote, fancy prose style, unquote, all the dazzling language and wonderful sentences and turns of phrase that Nabokov uses and get at the real truth, which is that Dolores Hayes was a young girl who was repeatedly traumatized but then manages to escape the clutches of Humbert Humbert. In doing so, she ends up with another predator, but she escapes his clutches and then, however briefly, goes on to live something resembling a normal life. And so, sure, we're supposed to have Humbert Humbert's epiphany that maybe he did love her after all, whatever that even means. But since he's so unreliable, let's flip it and actually look at what is happening to Dolores, that she has prevailed. She has survived. She has endured. And yes, it won't last very long, but even this brief period in which her survival enables her to make something of her life, that is something to really celebrate in some way.
Nabokov finishes Lolita in December of 1953. And there are many years you say figured he probably wouldn't finish it, but he does. And you mention how he started to grow anxious about the publication of it for obvious reasons. What did he suspect about the kind of outrage it would cause and the way publishers would react?
I think he rightfully feared that he would be subjected to obscenity laws, that he could be arrested, that the novel might get banned in multiple instances. All one had to look at is similar examples like Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence or Henry Miller's novels. So it wasn't as free and open as it would later become. Court cases in the 60s would sort of cement this idea that books weren't necessarily subject to obscenity laws as they had been before. And so several book publishers turned down Lolita because in their minds they computed the math and they didn't feel that they had enough money to defend Lolita in court if it came to that. What was so really quite incredible of Putnam's publisher, Walter Minton, is that he had no such fear. He had no such compunction. He just said, bring it on, and elected to publish it and to promote it and to market it. And so he wanted to capitalize on all of the controversy. He wanted it to be the most talked about novel. And indeed it was. And because it was so talked about, that meant more people bought it. And it became sort of this feedback loop that kept growing.
And it's, as we were just saying a moment ago, it creates the, this is how you describe it in the book. You say it sets in place this template for generations of readers, this phenomenon, this misinterpretation. And maybe that's not quite the way to say it, but this particular interpretation anyway, sets in place this template for generations of readers that they would forget that Dolores was Humbert Humbert's victim, not his seducer. And the fact that that became the spin, what was going on in the country culturally at the time that made people come to that kind of conclusion, I wonder?
I think it's that so many things were happening where girls were having an adolescence. There was juvenile delinquency, but also just this post-war America where gender roles were supposed to go back to the way they were before the war, because during the war, men went off to fight, women went off to work. And so after the end of World War II, women were supposed to go back into the home and look after the house and raise the children. And men were supposed to be the breadwinners and the providers. And sometimes that worked, but often it did not. So there was a lot of anxiety. And certainly the dawn of adolescence happened in a much more concerted way in addition. And thus teenagers were viewed as dangerous. And so again, I've mentioned this before, but I think the film version of Lolita really codified how people thought about the novel, rightly or wrongly, because having her depicted by someone who was a teenager as opposed to someone prepubescent made the story more palatable, even as making it more palatable actually did so much more damage. And so that's why looking at this cultural afterlife of Lolita was particularly fascinating to me, and I think important for readers to understand that things were really strange and weird, and America in general has a very complicated, messed up attitude about sex, but they also have a messed up attitude about what constitutes deviant sex and illegal sex. And so somehow, instead of staring this illicit and illegal relationship square in the face and seeing it for the horror that it actually is, it's like a denial mechanism would kick in. And again, it's this idea of Lolita as seductress as opposed to Lolita as trauma victim.
Yeah. There's been two films made of the book. Could a remake be made today, and should it? You kind of raise that question in the book.
I'm not sure. I mean, what's interesting too, and I wrote a piece about this, was there weren't just film remakes, but there were also adaptations in other theatrical forms. Yeah. In the early 1970s, a musical version of Lolita, eventually called Lolita My Love, attempted to get to Broadway. And it had a really A-list pedigree with Alan J. Lerner doing the libretto and the lyrics, John Barry, who did the James Bond theme, doing the music. And so for this piece, I read Lerner's various versions of the libretto, and none of them work because he didn't go back to the original source novel. He didn't go back to Nabokov's text. He based it on the film. And he was sort of working from this wild misinterpretation in addition. And going and doing this research and uncovering all of the horrible attitudes and the way that these girls were auditioned, it was just, it was icky. And so now it seems like there's a move to revive Lolita My Love in New York as part of sort of a concert style. And it's supposed to happen, I believe, in February. And I want to see it just to see if there's any way to make something of it, or if it really is as unadaptable as I think Lolita the novel really is. And one of the reasons I think that it's ultimately unadaptable is because when we're reading the novel, we experience Humbert Humbert's words And so that's the unreliability, but it's also a level of authority and trust that the reader can have. But once you see him depicted on screen or on stage or in some through some other veil, it's impossible to see anything other than this is a horrible situation and this poor girl is being victimized. And so to then play it for comedy or to play it as a love story, it just feels ever more dissonant.
So tell us what happens to Sally, how she gets away from Frank LaSalle and what happens when she finally gets home.
So she had gone on to Dallas and then she had a neighbor in the trailer park who sensed that something was terribly awry and that instead of Sally really being Frank LaSalle's daughter, that something much more sinister was afoot. And so this woman, Ruth Janish, helped engineer Sally's rescue when she and her own family moved to San Jose. And she wrote LaSalle and said, there's work to be had here. You should come to San Jose. So LaSalle and Sally moved from Dallas to San Jose. And within a couple of weeks, LaSalle's car broke down. He had to take the bus into town, leaving Sally alone and giving Ruth a chance to finally uncover the truth. Mm-hmm. And Sally finally trusted her enough to say what was really happening. And so Ruth helped Sally to make a long-distance phone call home. And this leads the actual FBI to come rescue her. And so Frank is arrested, and he pleads guilty, and Sally is home. And the prosecutor in Camden advises Sally and her mother that perhaps it's a good idea if they change their names, leave Camden. They do none of those things. Sally goes back to the school where she had been going before her abduction. And because of the news coverage, but also because she was in the same environment that she had been before, instead of being viewed as a victim, she was viewed as someone who had willingly given up her virginity to someone who was much older than herself and therefore a slut. And so she was essentially slut-shamed and had very few friends and was harassed. And so she was not really in the happiest of states. Sometimes she would lapse into depression, understandably, but it was the early 1950s. So she didn't really deal with it in ways that we deal with the after effects of trauma today. But she was starting to come out of it. She had made a close friend at the time. Her name was Carol Starts. And Sally and Carol then were working as waitresses for the summer of 1952. They were 15, and they were saving up to go to a different Jersey Shore town called Wildwood. And they take the bus together one day in August. And instead of going back on the bus with Carol, Sally makes the decision, having met a cute older boy, that she would go back in his car to his hometown and she would catch the bus from there. And unfortunately, Ed Baker's car spun out of control, hit a car, which hit another car. And though he escaped with minor injuries, Sally was killed instantly. And so I look at this as just the futility of this girl who just wanted to live a regular, normal life after what she had endured. And here, fate had the cruelest hand to play.
Say something finally about the reaction to the book.
I think what's been particularly gratifying is when people understand what it is that I was trying to do, that they can see that I wanted to be as compassionate and as humane in telling Sally's story. And one of the reasons that I hoped that I could do that is I never wanted to forget that she not just mattered as someone who suffered abuse and trauma, but also mattered to her own family. And so the reactions that I really treasure the most are from those who knew Sally. And by that, I also mean Sally's niece, Diana, who attended one of my events. And I know that it was an incredibly emotional experience for her doing so. But as I kept saying to her, and I would say publicly now, I never want to forget that Sally was an aunt. She was a daughter. She was a friend. She was a real person who had real value and real substance. And that's the impression that I want to leave with the reader. And by leaving that with the reader, I also want them to reconsider what we do when we make art and what responsibility we have as artists to the real people who we draw inspiration from. It doesn't mean, I should say, that I castigate Nabokov for writing Lolita. And I write fiction, and I've used real-life inspiration for fiction as well. But if you're going to do that, you have to set the bar outstandingly high. And I believe Lolita meets that standard, but I think all artists must strive to a similarly exacting standard and also recognize that even in setting that high standard, the reality should be in permanent conversation with the work of art. So what I mean is, when we think of Lolita, we should now also think of Sally Horner in parallel, intertwined. It should be a permanent conversation. I'm here to open up narratives. I don't want to close things down.
That's Sarah Weinman. Her book is The Real Lolita, The Kidnapping of Sally Horner and the Novel That Scandalized the World. She joined us from a studio in New York. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.